I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. I am really delighted that Dr. David Dark is here with us today. He teaches at Tennessee Prison for Women and Belmont University, where he is the Assistant Professor of Religion and the Arts in the College of Theology. He's written a number of books, and today we'll be talking about culture and the inescapability of religion, defined as what we are bound to and what our biggest ideas actually are. And these are some of the themes of his most recent book, which I've been reading, and it's very rich and enjoyable, and it's called Life is Too Short to Pretend You're Not Religious. So thank you so much, David, for being on my program today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so maybe you can give people a little bit of a context of your background and why you write on these type of topics, and then we can dive into some of the themes of your book.
Yes, I'm happy to. I have what I refer to as a weird religious background, and part of my argument is that everyone does, that we are all formed in strange and unique ways, not only by Sunday school curriculum or Torah or catechism, but by commercials and film and books and recording artists of all sorts. And one reason I try to insist on putting it that way is I believe I was myself spared a narrow, what we sometimes call fundamentalist toxicity, by way of Doctor Who, Star Trek, hip-hop, REM, all kinds of pop culture offerings that we're tempted to say, that's the secular stuff, and then you have your sacred stuff. But part of my argument is that that division dissolves upon contact with the way our hearts and minds really work. I think I also have a little bit of an axe to grind. Oh, that's just such a horrible image. It occurs to me. But I think one reason it's personal for me is I worry that when we try to distance ourselves from that toxicity by saying, I'm spiritual but not religious, we're falling into a trap. Phyllis Tickle, a theologian, once said that to say I'm spiritual but not religious is like saying I'm human but I'm not flesh and bone. And I'm trying to counter that oppositional energy that would say, so those people are religious, but I'm reasonable, I'm secular, I'm rational. Because I think when we do that, we lose the ethical heft and the wisdom available to us in Buddhism, Islam, Christianity, those traditions. So part of my argument, too, is let's not confuse the Bible, for instance, with all of the horrible things that people have said are in the Bible without reading the Bible closely, just to pick one text as an example.
Yeah, I think, speaking about secularism as if it is separated from religion, it's funny. I listened to the podcast by Josef Gustafsson, and he does the Catacombic Machine. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I know, but it sounds great.
It's really good. He's Swedish, and he has a really different, a really interesting perspective. But what he talks about is post-secularism and looking back at secularism as just sort of an offshoot of Protestantism.
Sure.
And just, using the same sorts of categories, using all the vestiges of Christianity, really, of Protestantism, and some post-modernity thrown in there, looking back and seeing that it's the same sort of moralistic categories in Nature, and there's sermonizing, and it's all done. But you know, of course, we're not religious, and we don't have a God, but it's all done in practically the same exact way.
Absolutely, there's so many ways of being dogmatic.
Yeah, right. And so it's sort of the religion without the Christian God or Yahweh, yeah, or something, but it's still pretty much in almost every other single way. It's very religious, in fact, almost like embarrassingly,
yeah,
religious, sometimes more religious than you could say certain Christians are who even attend church and things. And I was noticing that as he said that, it rang true, but then I just saw it popping out everywhere once it was brought, yeah, to mind more clearly.
Sure. Well, we are, I would argue, when I say religion, if somebody wanted to say, oh, you're for religion, I would want to say, you know, I think that it's impossible to be for religion. I also think it's impossible to be against religion. I think believing that you could do either would be like being opposed to the formation of a line at Starbucks. That religion is just cultural formation of any sort. And I try to define it, you know, to narrow it down a little bit. I say that religion is your controlling story, for better or worse. And for better, we are capable of changing our controlling story at any time.
Yeah, you say in the book, for better or worse, we all drink the Kool-Aid and religion happens. And
yeah,
that you have been drinking the Kool-Aid of Radiohead, for instance, or and you can get down to what people actually believe in by asking them some of those types of things that they're bound to.
Yes. A quick little formula for that is I use the word witness, and I say your religion is your witness, is the shape your loves and hates take.
Yeah. And I think the word religion has been sort of poisoned, I guess you could say it. So the first thing, people bristle at first when I'm sure they hear your title of your book, or they think, of course not, or, you know, religion is, you know, this thing that's oppressed us and come along and tried to force us to believe certain very specific things.
Yes, indeed. Religion does that.
And you talk about tradition as a transfer of stories and images.
Yeah. Well, tradition, you've got the T-R-A-D, tradere, to pass on, to trade over. And to say that one is for tradition is also a little something of a void of content statement, because there's good traditions and there's bad traditions. But I do find it helpful. I mean, just for a popular reference, when The Force Awakens came out and then we got Rogue One, I would say both instances, maybe especially Rogue One, are deepenings of the Star Wars tradition. And there's a sense in which Star Wars is a more living tradition in the world than a lot of the other things that we call, I mean, Star Wars is itself a kind of world religion that one, many people strive to be faithful to. I actually find it helpful if someone was to say, well, it sounds like you're a Christian. I want to say, okay, we'll stop there. Tell me what you mean by that. And we can figure out whether or not that label, describes me. But I would draw from the Star Wars tradition by, if they said, okay, well, define a Christian, and I would say, well, I believe a Christian, in my view, is someone who you could observe that person's life, the way they talk about people, the way they spend their money, their actions, and you could conclude that Jesus of Nazareth is that person's Jedi master. And if I say that, then suddenly one tradition, Star Wars, which of course is a hybrid of all manner of ancient traditions, can help elucidate or illuminate what we mean when we speak of the other tradition, Christianity.
And really, Star Wars is so easily recognizable and understandable. People know kind of exactly what you mean when you say that.
Yeah.
You know, that's more easily understood than than Jewish culture, for instance.
Mm-hmm. I was to say my living room is full of Star Wars memorabilia, but it has nothing to do with my religion. I would want to say you're going to want to expand religion, your understanding of that word a little bit more, because we know what our witness is by looking at hard at how we're trying to, what it is we're interested in broadcasting about ourselves, namely our love for Star Wars or whatever it might be.
You're also mentioning in your book, we are who we pretend to be. And you go into that quite a bit. And that's like a little teeny, that's a little teeny part of it. I would love it if you would expound a little bit on that and what you're driving at there.
Absolutely. I hope I'm getting the quote right when I say, I believe I'm quoting Kurt Vonnegut, who said, we become what we pretend to be. So we need to be very careful what we pretend to be. And I'll mention that persona is Greek for mask. So even when we speak of personality, we're already involved in theater imagery. We're involved in acting, in roles. And I note fairly early on, as I tell a story about some of my own little meaning crises as a teenager, in which my lonely reading of the Bible led me down some paths of self-hatred and worry and anxiety. And I very specifically say that in that sadness, I was often rescued by the thought of Steve Martin, who I admired very much, whose comedy albums were important to me, who was something of a he was part of my great cloud of pop culture witnesses. And I can't even mention Steve Martin without noting that as a 17-year-old, I was consciously, unselfconsciously imitating him. And I'm probably, I don't know if it comes through in my voice, but I'm probably imitating him a little bit now, because he was someone from whom I derived much hope, as was the case with Woody Allen and Dostoevsky and all kinds of folks that I was reading in the late 80s. So we become what we love in so many ways, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously. And how we present ourselves to each other is a really big deal. I'll throw in, too, that one way of thinking of that is we each of us have a kind of pantheon of elders, or an attention collection in our minds, people we've known, people we've admired. And it's difficult to hold that out with open hands, because often we deny our influences rather than embracing them. And hopefully this isn't too much of a tangent, but I'll note that as a teenager driving to school, I developed a fondness for the talk radio madman Rush Limbaugh, who you have perhaps heard of. And Rush Limbaugh made me feel strong. He gave me arguments. He gave me ways of putting things. And I would quote him to people without realizing, without letting them know that I was quoting him. And I would probably quote him without letting myself know that I was quoting him, because he was modeling this kind of, here's what's what, and here's what the media does, here's what those politicians are doing. But blessedly, people who realized I was doing that, who maybe knew that Rush Limbaugh wasn't the healthiest mentor to have in my mind, did not judge me solely by my love for Rush Limbaugh. And they gradually helped me to see that I could perhaps do with some other voices. And eventually, and this is a strange image, but if I imagine Limbaugh as one of the many voices in my mind, it became less and less appropriate for him to have the microphone in my own thinking. And I think that's kind of how conversion works. I think it's how evolution works. And I think it's how pilgrimage works, as in we learn to silence those more toxic voices in our mind, maybe not even silence, but just not let them dominate. And I think we do that with all kinds of things, with music, with Netflix series, with poets and novelists and podcasts. And I think it's just a work that we're all called to all the time. And I think it's a deeply religious work.
What culturally right now has your attention, and what do you think speaks into the world in art or media and film or music, something that needs to be heard by more people?
Well, lately, I mean, we're just a few days out from Beyoncé's Grammy performance and her speech. We also heard from Chance the Rapper that evening. And those are two who have become really, really important to me lately. Certainly Congressman John Lewis, I think of his March trilogy, that comic book, has been rather essential. And for me, all kinds of less famous people too, the poet Fanny Howe, the Jesuit poet who we lost almost a year ago, maybe 9 months, Daniel Berrigan. Yes, Black Mirror. I mean, all kinds of stuff. I'm always taking stuff in and listening and reading and watching things that my kids are telling me about these days.
And there's so much with all of the Amazon Prime, Netflix, like more things coming out all the time, mm-hmm. that compete with, you know, the many other cable shows and things like that. But I think movie quality type of programming too.
Yes, indeed. No doubt.
Well, maybe you can pick out one of those things that you mentioned and drill down a little deeper into something specific and what and some kind of impression it's made on you and what it says.
Yes, well, I'll be happy to. John Lewis recently made headlines by acknowledging that he did not think of Donald Trump, who I think of as public servant 45, as a legitimate president. And that went everywhere. But what was missed in that was when he was asked the question of what do you think of Donald Trump, his first line was, "I believe in forgiveness." He paused. And I mentioned that when I think about him saying, "I believe in forgiveness," I think of Beyoncé's performance, in which one of the last things she said was, "Reconciliation is possible." So often, I mean, we do live in a world where there are people who view every honest question, comment, even song lyrics as a perceived slight. And we do live in a world in which many people, even though Chance the Rapper was lifting up the name of God and Beyoncé was lifting up motherhood, which everyone is involved in motherhood. Every human being owes their existence to a mother. But celebrating a mother, especially a Black woman celebrating her own maternalness, there are those who watch something like that and are only offended by it and do not feel invited into that process of reconciliation, into that process of acknowledging the fact of your own dependence upon other people, your own place in what Martin Luther King Jr. refers to as an inescapable network of mutuality. And I think of both, I guess if I can just do all three of those, I believe that when Chance the Rapper says, "Wave your hands if you believe that love is stronger than hatred." I mean, that's a very basic human species neighborhood insight. To say, when someone says, "Raise your hand if you believe love is stronger than hatred," that somebody's suddenly getting political, is is to have a rather truncated, shriveled sense of self. But in our day, we are in danger of letting the world be reduced to the size of someone else's fear. And, I think we have to resist that. And so all the things that I mention are kind of part of my quiver of thoughtfulness lately. Like these are images, songs, writers, voices that are in my own canon. If we were to say canon, a C-A-N-O-N, the biblical canon, these are the books that the Jewish community and the Christian community decided were essential to living the kind of life that they want to live. And so I have a canon with all kinds of things. But lately, some of the essentials within my canon, my quiver of thoughtfulness, have been some of those voices.
I think I've been studying, drilling down into a lot more neuroscience in the last year and a half, 2 years. And prior to that, I got a master's degree in spiritual formation. So it's kind of, to me, that like the natural outgrowth of that and how transformation happens. But what's actually happening in the brain and realizing that the brain is mainly predictive and then meaning making. And so that you have these really active amygdalas and, you know, basically predicting fear and predicting a fight before anything happens. Then it happens, and then the emotions catch up with the prediction and connect all the dots. And so you can't kind of undo that because the you perceive what you have already made up your mind about prior to seeing it.
Yeah.
And so it's it really takes a redoing, a transformation of your mind, and it really takes really understanding someone else's story. So that,
absolutely.
Yeah, and empathy, like a real empathy where you you can't tweet to the other person. You would actually have to have a communion with them, a meal or.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
So I appreciate, and I think that's where art really does bridge the gaps. You talk a lot about poetry and your
it's
love
for poetry.
It's the
only thing that can, I want to say.
Maybe you can talk a little more about that.
Well, story. If you can get someone to follow a story that you're telling, it's almost like a, I don't want to say sneak attack because that's already borrowing violent imagery. But William Stringfellow, Harlem lawyer, theologian from, I think he died in the 80s, but he would have hid, he was involved in hiding Daniel Berrigan when Berrigan was on the run, having burned some draft files. In Catonsville. Sorry for that tangent. I've tried to explain who Stringfellow is before I quote him, but he said that listening is a rare happening among human beings. We generally let the other person talk, and while they're talking, we're preparing our statement. What you just described is predictive. And then before we've had the chance to listen to them at all, we weigh in. And of course, we have this modeled for us in presidential debates and interviews and news, alleged talk shows all the time. But with art, art sneaks up on you. Art disarms. Art cries reality in a way that words, argument don't. Story does as well. Parables. Because if you take in a parable, you are allowing yourself to enter into the world of the parable. And when you exit that world, the world itself is different. But of course, yes, as a teacher, I know that if a student believes that I just think that they are a bigot or narrow or stupid, that student can't hear me. No matter what I say, all the predictive brain will do is Dr. Dark thinks that I'm stupid or insufficient or deficient in some way. So it is, I mean, this would be part of when John Lewis refers to the beloved community of the civil rights era, that is that posture of caring for the person who opposes you, trying to care for them as much as you care for yourself, or at least be as concerned for their soul as you are for your own. And I think that would, the little proverb that King gives us is that the image of God is never totally gone in anyone, even the person who's coming at you with a stick or a bat or something like that. And I think we need some equivalent of that when we're in conversation with people who we believe are only bent on our destruction. We get to somehow look into the aggressive, seemingly endlessly adversarial person and see them as the wounded child or the traumatized psyche that they are. Fred Rogers of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood is really helpful on this. I hasn't gone up online yet, but I've done some writing about his testimony before a Senate subcommittee in 1969 when he was trying to talk the Senate into funding public television by describing what he does with puppets and songs and all of this with children, with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, who I'm guessing most of your listeners are familiar with Mr. Rogers, who was a Presbyterian minister, as well as a public television personality. But he said that his job, with all of the songs, the puppets, the stories, is to deliver a service that would assist the possibility of mental health in the United States. And he said that his bottom line message to viewers, children and adult children alike, is to communicate that feelings are mentionable and manageable. And I found that really, really helpful, because I think even when we're listening to people who can't change their minds and won't change the subject, somewhere in there, there is this fear that their feelings are neither mentionable nor manageable. And if we can somehow give that to people over food, over coffee, over long conversations, I think that's really the only way that righteousness can exist in the land of the living.
I don't know if you got to hear John Lewis when he was on the On Being podcast. By the time I've mentioned two podcasts since talking to you, you know I'm a little bit of a, that's kind of my thing.
Well, no, I think I feel of that, the On Being podcast with John Lewis, that belongs in everyone's personal canon, because it's so essential to these radioactive days.
Yes, yes. And once you hear his witness, his way he sees the world and sees other people and even people who wanted him in the hospital or dead, you realize there's a lot going on there that you're never going to hear in a sound clip. And you're never going to understand, especially if you're removed from the civil rights era as much as I am. I'm in my 40s and I didn't live during that time. Uh-huh. It's really important for people under, I'd say, 45 or 50 to really get acquainted with that from someone who lived in that time and marched in that time.
Yes, indeed.
And not just hear from an echo chamber on either side of the political aisle, because someone who was there and has that kind of witness is super important to hear out. And I will put in the show notes a link to that episode, because I think that's just one of those must hear. I agree with you.
Yeah, it's major. I will note, this is in the comic book, the March trilogy, when he's on the bridge in Selma and they are preparing to be beaten by law enforcement. There was a minister beside him. Well, they were warned, you know, this is an unlawful assembly, according to our understanding of the law, and you will disperse. And they, of course, refused to disperse. But in their refusal, at one point, a minister next to Lewis said to the highway patrol captain, may we have a word with, you know, they were operating on the orders of the governor, but it was something like, may we have a word with the captain, to which via megaphone, what they heard back was, there is no word to be had, which was such a cold, devastating, prepare to die or have lasting injury inflicted upon you. So they prayed and then they were beaten. But there was a word to be had because it was televised and it changed everything. And, I've thought a lot about that with, when I've watched press conferences in which straightforward, honest questions are batted down as if they were a physical attack. But as long as there is a word to be had, there is hope. There's the possibility of relationship. And that's been a little mantra for me lately. There is a word to be had. If I can get people, I mean, in some of those... goodness, when you're watching the split screen on CNN or something, it is as if there's a kind of soft exorcism going on in which one human being is trying to get another human being to acknowledge that they don't believe the words coming out of their own mouths. But again, as long as there's follow-up, as long as we can talk, there is space in which light and candor and truth can get through.
Yeah, I think it's easy to, we're in these times where there's obviously it's a struggle and a lot of people are frustrated and it's hard to see past whatever position we're in right now that maybe things will improve or maybe there's reason to have hope. And there's, I think there's going to be, like we were saying, art is one way that can happen, that just, I think there's a danger of just becoming weary on a diet of perpetual outrage.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Yes. And people die on that diet. People, I mean, I will say this might be too much information. Since, you know, November 11/9, I'm 47, but I've become much more aware of my own heartbeat and my own body. And I've had to really think through, okay, drink more water, get more sleep, and turn off the high-powered hose of information that you don't know what to do with for a few hours a day. Just because I can check in to see what the latest is doesn't mean that I should or that it's going to serve any need other than getting me worked up. And I think that, you know, thinking about my own pulse and my own stress level has had me more feelingly aware of how theoretical, the rage is real, like I should say, but theoretical relationship with famous billionaires who I'm never going to be in actual contact with, that that pseudo, it's not pseudo stress, but imagining other people and how angry I am with them, even though I'm never going to talk to them, that can weigh down on the nervous system in such a way that it can kill. It can shorten the lifespan. And I've had to kind of fight a little bit to try to be true to those real in the flesh relationships, the little circle of effectiveness that I have, because it is so easy to flee the fact of family, neighborhood, all of the people who could do well with me caring about them in the name of shaking a fist at people miles away that I just can't believe what they just said. The sort of the pseudo intimacy in which celebrities dance or something like that.
You're right. Right.
Keep real is a, it's a life's work for everybody throughout history, but it is a temptation to kind of rut away my waking hours over things that I don't really have any power over.
Right. Well, and there's something to be said for a liturgy, a work of the people that is intimate, that is people close at hand, that you're always at your liturgy. You know, there is always something to be done in person. Or, you know, I've been thinking more about myself in the entire month of February doing, it took a strange and an embarrassing amount of courage to delete my Twitter and Facebook app off my phone, but, but oh my goodness, I did it. And then I just, you know, interact on my computer like once or twice a day on social media. Then I back away slowly and try to.
It'll be there when you come back.
It'll be there like a fire hose. Yes. And just think, you know, I'm actually going to write some handwritten letters and I'm going to do a few things differently, like the old timey days. And
that's right.
But it is soothing to my soul. And I've reached out to coworkers then, and I've reached out to people that are new in my neighborhood and just made this really conscious effort to be like, I don't have the people I'm communicating with some of them I dearly enjoy, really enjoy. I'd say 95% of the people I interact with online are extremely positive experiences, but I am not in their actual lives day to day. It's encouraging to speak with them, but I have a couple kids, I have neighbors, I have, you know, people I associate with, and I could also look them in the eye a bit more. And, you know,
so
it's this tug and pull of a life in a sense that was sort of thrust very quickly on us. And I don't think we've adjusted properly yet, maybe.
No.
Or maybe it's just I haven't. But I know that we all have sort of been sucked into our devices. And I was thinking just the other day, just yesterday, that when you see a movie on the screen now and people talking to each other and interacting and a story unfolds, you're thinking that would never happen. Everybody's just looking at their phone and not paying any attention to each other. This is so fiction.
Yes, indeed. Now, there's a Wim Wenders film called Until the End of the World, in which there were devices whereby we could record our own dreams. And what happened is people did record their dreams, but then in their waking hours, they're just staring at the footage of their own dreams. And so you walk around and you have people lying under trees or on sidewalks, staring at the screen that contained their own dreams. This film came out in 92, I think. But it was prophetic because it is the world we're in, where we can't pull ourselves away. And as a teacher, it's a struggle. I picked this up from a fellow called Will Campbell. But sometimes, just as a bit of an experiment, I say to my students, I'm going to have to ask you to put your electric soul molesters away for a moment, so that we can talk. And once, when a student pushed back and said, "Why would you call it that?" I said, "Because it robs you of our presence, and it robs us of yours. That there's the possibility of being present to one another is the hope of the species in so many ways. Doesn't mean these tools aren't useful, but they really can pull us away from the fact of our own lives." I think of the French sociologist Jacques Ellul, who said probably in the 80s, a computer is not a companion, it's a vampire. And he had no idea what was coming.
Yeah, that was early on, yeah.
Wow.
Goodness. Well, I was interested to see if you could, you've written several books that of course you've whet my appetite. I really enjoy the quality of your writing as well. And so maybe if you would mention some of the other books you've written and briefly what they're about, because I'd like to include those in the show notes as well as add them to my own reading list.
Oh, well, thank you. And I would love doing that.
And then just where you can be found, for where people could dig into more of what you do and what you're up to, because we've really just barely scratched the surface. And so I do hope to have you back on in maybe the summer or fall.
Yeah, I'd welcome that. I'll mention my first one is called Everyday Apocalypse, The Sacred revealed in Radiohead, The Simpsons, and other pop culture icons. And that's essentially taking, there's a lot of Bible in there, but there's also Beck and The Matrix and Truman Show, Flannery O'Connor, and lifting up Apocalypse as not the destruction of the world, but as revelation. If Walking Dead is apocalyptic, it's because Walking Dead makes us more aware of where we already are, what our core commitments are. Apocalypse is that which cracks the pavement of the status quo. And another one is Gospel According to America, a meditation on a God-blessed, Christ-haunted idea. And that was me trying to take the possibility of the righteous witness of Christianity away, Well, I'll just say that after 9/11, a number of people seem to be confusing God's kingdom for the perceived self-interest of the United States. And I was trying to challenge that by way of Herman Melville and Twilight Zone and Bob Dylan, the same old, same old. And another one is The Sacredness of Questioning Everything, which just lifts up questioning not as something that's just permitted by for people of faith, but essential to the work of faith itself. And then the latest, with a provocative title, it can really upset people if they don't read past the title, is Life's Too Short to Pretend You're Not Religious. And I'll say I'm on Twitter as David Dark, and there's a daviddark.org that has all of my pieces from MTV and Pitchfork and that kind of thing.
You've got the perfect name for this. It's very mysterious. It's kind of sci-fi, because I know you like the sci-fi stuff. It's,
oh, I do.
If Dr. Dark isn't like a Marvel villain, I don't know what.
Exactly. No, absolutely. Well, my brother is also a Dr. Dark. He's been one longer than me. So I've said, you can be the DC Dr. Dark, but I have to be the Marvel Dr. Dark.
I want to see sketches of costumes and post those on Twitter or something.
Oh,
like
sure.
Well, this has been so fun, and I really do hope to have you back maybe in a few months from now or something, and I'll make sure to keep in touch with you.
I would welcome that.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. I've created an all-access pass, and you can access the access pass for just $1. It unlocks all show note episodes, too. It's a reoccurring $1 a month, and you can cancel at any time. Just go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E. patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes or your podcast app, and I invite you to sign up for my newsletter at sparkmymuse.com. I try to send out a message once or twice a month. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.